I'm going to repeat myself just a little bit, but I want to do that. I want you to know how special I feel about you. My wife and I both think you're very special people. We're grateful to be here. It's good to be a part of the congregation this morning as we study together. And I truly hope it'll be beneficial as we study the subject of Islam. Appreciate the young people that are here very much. Appreciate your faith and your willingness to be a part of the work and to participate the way that you do. I want to back this up, I think, a little bit as we look at it this morning. We're studying about Islam. I want you to know I've done a lot of research on this, more, I think, than any sermon I've ever preached in my life. I sort of felt like the fellow trying to pick up an elephant. How do you get a grip on it? There's no good place to begin, hardly. So we started this morning in class looking at the three religions that began somewhat with Abraham. Abraham was the father of the Jewish people as well as the father of Ishmael. And through Ishmael and Mohammed, finally, the Islamic religion began. The Jewish religion ended at the cross because the people did not accept the Messiah and were not interested in being a part of the Jewish religion today. But we are Christians, and that also had its roots in Abraham. But our study this morning is the idea of Islam, because we're dealing with it more in our country now than we've ever done that before. Many cities have mosques or places of worship. We see people at the drugstore, we see people at the grocery store, we see people all the time who wear the apparel of Muslims. It makes us wonder, what do you believe? And we want to be sure about that. They're in the news all the time, especially now in conflicts in the Mideast. A lot of people are dying. A lot of wars continue. Strangely enough, there are conflicts between Muslims themselves as well as what they consider the infidels, and that would be us. This morning we want to look together at the idea of Islam, and that would be their logo, as we would say about that. But as we study this together, we want to took a number of points that we'll be able to look at and understand the objectives of the lesson to examine the background of the religion of Islam. We did that a little bit this morning, and we'll be doing that a little bit further, that we really understand where it came from and what it consists of. To understand better the Arab Islamic culture, we need to emphasize that not all Arabs are Islamic, but it began in Arabia, and that's why many people connected to the idea of the Arab Islamic culture. To comprehend the nature of the Islamic faith and how it relates to those of us who are Christians as well. To make a fair and rigorous comparison of Islam and New Testament Christianity. I want us to be very sure about what we believe in Christ. The Bible is very clear. The New Testament teaches us very clearly what to believe about Jesus Christ. And when you see other religions, you recognize that some of them have as dedicated a faith to their religion as we have to the religion of Christ. But it's somewhat necessary to understand it, as you have the Islamic faith is the fastest growing religion in the world today. Billions of people embrace the Islamic faith, and it's going to have an impact upon us. Outside of Mecca, there's a little mountain called Mount Hira. And that's where the birth, rise, and growth of Islam began, because Mohammed would make it a practice to go out to a cave on that particular mountain, and there he would receive many of his revelations. And that's just one of the many places we'll be looking at. The Arabian Peninsula, as it is looked at there, would be the root ground of where the Islamic religion really began at Mecca. So you have Arabia and Mohammed as the important characters that we'll be looking at this morning and through the week as we consider looking at these. He was born in 570 A.D., so he's not to be confused with a New Testament character. He came along much later than the New Testament is talking about, and came into a society that was very polytheistic, and he was not of that sort. He was a Bedouin, and had what we call it raised with tribal life. It was fragmented, warring. There was a lot of war, and war is a great deal of the history of this particular religion. I don't believe you can do a fair comparison about what they teach and what they practice without recognizing that they've been a violent people all of their life. Go back even to Ishmael, and you find out that that's so as it regards him. The tribal leader of each of the Bedouin tribes had all the authority, and thus they were very splintered, and it was somewhat of a tactic that he was able to maneuver when Muhammad began to unite all of these tribes from the Bedouin tribes into a state. But he was able to do that. And that's an important part of understanding their history. They made the caravan trade a part of their society. You heard about the Silk Road and various caravans that were active during those days. And that's how they sometimes fought each other and robbed the caravans, and how they got part of their money. It was sort of their way of life in the process. But as you begin to look at this as the religion itself, and in Muhammad's day, when he was born, it was polytheistic. They believed in many gods. And the black granite cube that we talked about earlier had over 600 idols in it as he was growing up. And he began to understand that this was wrong. But they believed in nature gods. They would worship the sun or the moon or the stars and have various kinds of gods that they would worship. They had idols that they built. And that worship was centered in Mecca, one of the great cities of the Arabian Peninsula. And that's where he was at the time. This is, again, a drawing of the Kaaba, or the granite building in the center of the Islamic mosque in Mecca. And it is something that is very much central to them, because Muhammad knew that that was full of idols. And he cleaned it out when he came back to Mecca with 10,000 of his followers and conquered the city. And there's an annual pilgrimage that people make to go and be there, and we'll notice some of that as we go along. So even in the polytheistic religion, they had a god called Allah. And he was the creator god, or the major god. And so Muhammad took that name as the name for God and began to worship Allah, but he tore out the idols. You see, the Bedouin tribes, that's pretty much the way it was when he was growing up, and they did not have a unified state at all. So they were constantly warring, and different people had the influence, but he was able to maneuver all those into a state that was very important. His early life, raised mostly by his uncle, his father died before he was born. His mother died shortly after he was born, so his grandfather began to raise him, and he died. And so finally he lived with his uncle most of his life. He worked on the caravans and with the herds and became somewhat of a businessman. At 25, a very rich widow married him and made him pretty much the agent of her wealth. And they had a long and rich marriage, evidently. He did not practice polygamy at that time. Later, he had 13 wives. But at this point, he had just the one wife and remained faithful to her during that period of time. He was 40 years of age when he is said to receive the first divine communication in the solitude of the mountain that we showed you a moment ago near Mecca. He said that Gabriel, the angel, appeared to him and, in the name of God, commanded him to read or to recite the message. That is, to preach the true religion and to spread it abroad, committing it to writing. The writings are contained in the Quran, and that's spelled different ways, but it's the official writing of the Islamic religion. When you look at this and recognize that he became familiar with the Bible, because he incorporates some parts of the Bible into his religion, he also incorporates a number of myths. For example, one of the Catholic writings that I have read, and he incorporates that into the Quran, is the story of Jesus working miracles when he was a boy. That he would make little clay birds and cause them to fly by a miracle. And one of his friends broke a little clay bird or killed a bird that he had made into an animal, and he struck the boy blind and deaf. So he worked some of that into his writings as well. And so it's something that is a mixture of some Bible, his own so-called revelations, and the traditions that he knew about. The call to be a prophet was very important to him. Muslim teaching says that Angel Gabriel spoke to him, and he began to reveal God's will in 610, when he's about 40. And Muslims teach that revelations occurred over 22 years. Now, during the time that he was alive, these might have been jotted down. They said sometimes people jotted those down on palm leaves or scraps of paper or parchment or some sort. But after he died, it began to be collected. It was not collected until after he died, and the Quran was not put together until after he died. And they were pulled together, and Muslims teach that this is the only true religion that's infallible. That there's no mistakes at all in the Quran. The Bible is supposedly full of mistakes. It's been corrupted to Isaac rather than Ishmael, and therefore it's not to be trusted, although they will talk about the Gospels and that is part of Scripture. You have the Quran then written in the Arabic language, usually. His life was somewhat tumultuous. He led 27 military campaigns against villages and caravans and planned 38 others during the process of spreading Islam. So if I would be a member of the Church of Christ and decide that I wanted the church to grow, I would get some guns and some weapons and arm all of you, and we'd go out and we'd compel people to be Christians after the way that we preach and believe. Well, that's what he was doing. It was not a matter of simply evangelism. It was a matter of just sort of teaching people. He conquered with a sword. For example, when he came back to Mecca with 10,000 of his followers, all the idol worshippers were either killed or made to commit to Islam, and therefore he wiped out polytheism. Well, we could grow if we would take that militaristic type of view, but they call it the religion of peace. You'll see that in many of the writings. Islam means peace, and they use the salam word a lot. Muhammad posed as an apostle of God, yet his life is filled with lustfulness, 12 or 13 marriages, and had sex with a 9-year-old child. He had slaves and concubines. They're known for their rapes, and in modern terminology, the military people that are now practicing in Afghanistan and in Iraq have rape squads that they send out to the women they're conquering. And by the way, most of those are Muslim women. And so the Sunnis and the Shias are fighting each other, and then you have the so-called radical one, such as the ISIS, and they will kill both Shia and Sunni unless you submit to their will. It's a religion of peace if you're peaceful under their control, and otherwise their conquests are brutal, and they have unmerciful butcheries of things that they do to individuals. So Islam means submission, and you'll be at peace if you submit. And a Muslim is one who submits, the follower of the religion of Islam. And so when you hear these words tossed about Islam and Muslim, you'll be able to make a distinction as to which is what and what you're talking about. There was opposition in Mecca, going back to when he first began to preach monotheism, and there were a few converts. And the reason it threatened the social order, they had ungodly lives. And he was talking about a moral living, and he picked up some of the Old Testament laws and began to teach those. And it was a disruption of the Mecca way of life. So there was a lot of opposition to him during that time. He and his followers were very much persecuted, and there was a plot to kill him, and he fled to Medina during that period of time. You can see where Mecca is on this map, and then he fled up to Medina, or Medina, depending on how you do that. There are not a great deal of towns in Arabia because of the desert, but these two are very important with regard to the future and the past of the Mohammedan religion. So in 622, they flee to Medina to get away from Mecca, and he begins to help with tribal conflicts. He's a good military man, in addition to have this conviction. And here's the thing that we can pick up lessons from people about what they are. Muhammad believed he was right. In America today, there's a great deal of diversity. One is as good as another. And this is preached in schools. This is preached in religions, that one is as good as another. One denomination is as good as another. Brethren, we need to understand the conviction that Muhammad said he was right. He believed that. We need to believe in the Bible with the same sense of dedication. We need to understand the Bible is right. We need to understand that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. We need to believe that Jesus built the church, Matthew 16, verse 18, and have that sense of dedication with regard to that as he did with the Islamic religion. So as he came with his sense of dedication, he was very experienced as a military leader, He began to combine these tribes into a group of people under his control. And so he became quite a great man in influence with thousands of followers. And this first Islamic community is formed. I can't tell you how important it is that we understand that with regard to the Islam religion. When they have a community, it is a total community, so that it's very difficult for them to assimilate. We say when people come to America, they should assimilate, they should become Americans. They're not going to do that. They have a complete existence as a community with regard to laws and politics and religion, and they're going to be separate people. So you find them in the cities across America now, and they do not grow as, say, the Mexican-American community has, where they blend in and all of that. They have their own way of life. Pardon me. And they're going to force that way of life upon everyone. We'll see that more as we go along throughout the week. Really important to understand that, how they operate. So one man said, whereas in Mecca, Muhammad and his followers had given rise to a new religious sect, in Medina they forged a state. Now that idea of a state is brought over to America as well. They want America to be an Islamic state. They want France and England and Germany to be an Islamic state. One thing that we'll note that I don't really have the material, I don't remember where I put it. In England and France and Germany, in Holland and in Canada, by 15 more years at the going rate of population growth, the Muslim community is going to be a majority in all of these states. That includes England and France. When they have a majority, they take over that state. Their dedication is to an Islamic state in America. As an American, we need to understand that. As a Christian, there's a possibility of future persecution of Christians. And it may not be in my day, but we need to recognize that young people here may see a change if they ever have a majority in America. The danger would be that in Canada and in Germany and in London, some of these are atomic states. They have atomic bombs in their arsenal. And if they have control of the state, they will have control of those arms. We've already seen in modern warfare, they do not hesitate to use the weapons of the countries they invade. They will take those weapons and begin to use those weapons against the inhabitants of that particular state. And I'm not saying anything that's not proven so far as the Quran is concerned as well, as we'll be noting that. So to be a Muslim meant at once to adhere to a faith or religion and to be a member of a certain political community. The dual nature of Islam is established and remains even today. And that's the total picture of the Islamic faith that something we'll be having to face. Said further that Islam, the offspring of Arabia and the Arabian prophet, was not only a system of belief and cult, it was a system of state, society, law, thought, and art, a civilization with religion as its unifying, eventually dominating factor. And the idea that presents itself to us is that America will have to change its ideas of freedom and individual liberty. Once you have the Muslim community in charge, your freedoms are taken away. You will be at peace if you live under their rules and regulations. Religion is not allowed. Freedom of religion, freedom of speech is not allowed. So the point with regard to America is one thing. With regard to the Church of Christ, it's something else. We're interested as Christians in what it's going to be if we have to face that. We're interested as Americans if we have to face that as well. It's necessary that you understand this is a total package deal from the standpoint of politics, religion, law, and society, the way they treat women, the way they treat children, the way they treat politics. All of that is a dominating thing, and that will be something that will be faced in the religion that they control. And so Mohammed's influence then, once he got to Mecca, began to increase among the other tribesmen. He built a following through diplomacy and effective leadership and military success. He was quite an important man and a capable man. Islam spread effectively by the sword, by indoctrination, and by warfare. And that would still be the way that it's going to be done even today, as we see in modern terminology. Mecca surrendered to him in 630. He purged the city of idols, and they converted to Islam. He returned to Medina, and he died in 632. So he did not live to be a long old man, but the point is that he had already changed his world by the time he passed away. He had a sense of dedicated followers around him, and I see a similarity between Jesus and the apostles and the caliphates and Mohammed, that they were around him and they were really faithful to him because they believed he was a prophet, an apostle. And so you have the blending of politics and religion. And again, that's important to understand that. I don't think you really understand Islam if you don't get this point. It's not just a religion. It is not just a political arm. It is a combination of an entire lifestyle, and they are dedicated to that lifestyle. So when they come to America, they're going to keep that lifestyle. Now, if you do a little work on the internet, you'll be able to find out that in Dearborn, for example, Dearborn, Michigan, they have a majority. And when you're in an Islamic country, they have the call to prayer from their mosques. In Dearborn, they have the call to prayer. It was okayed by the city council because they had a majority on the board, and they will change your way of life. That's the important thing for us to understand as Americans. If they get a majority, they will change your way of life. Their way of life, they believe, is the perfect way of life. Your way of life is confusing. You have too much individual liberty. You have freedom of religion. You have freedom of press. All these things will be taken away, because they're not going to allow those things to happen. So they have that. So the role of civil authority to safeguard Islam, you hear about Sharia law. In Dearborn, Michigan, and this is also being promoted in other towns, they want the Muslims not to be under the American civil law. They want Muslims in every city to be under Sharia law. That permits a man, for example, if his daughter is raped, he's able to kill her to restore his honor. That's part of Sharia law. A woman who is raped is going to have four witnesses, or she cannot have any recourse. Well, of course, that's not going to happen usually in most cases. And she is considered shamed. She's not the victim. She's shamed by that. And people have been known to kill their daughters because she has had that victim take place. So Sharia law is the particular law of the system of the Islamic religion. And it's being brought into America. And people are wanting, the Muslim communities want to be governed by Sharia law, not American law. Our way of life is going to be challenged if we allow that to take place. There's no separation originally, but Muhammad and his disciples were ruthless in suppressing apostasy, and so it became a part of that system and remains a part of that system today. I want to go briefly through some of the older civilizations and their expansion. During the 7th and 8th century, more Bedouin tribes were pulled into the community, became the entire state of Arabia, raids for plunder. If you remember the caravans, they fought each other for plunder. Well, they did the same thing all the way through the Islamic, because they made money from that, and the Islamic rule was profiting by the plunder from those caravan raids. Now they have an emerging and unifying civilization. Take with them, they have faith and a cause. And this was true back during those centuries. Then, as it began to spread, you have the Arabian Peninsula, where it was in the beginning, and it totally covered that. I just want to mention how it spread. It went into Egypt, into Cairo, then it went into Persia, and you began to have a spread of it in different places. In 636, it went into the Canaan, Palestine area. 637, it went more into Persia. In 641, it deepened, and they controlled almost all of Persia. 645, they began to conquer northern Africa. And on different occasions, they just spread all the way through that areas. And it was a rapidly spreading. It's doing that again today. The spreading of Islam is very rapid and very thorough, even into India by the year 712. Of course, that was after the death of Muhammad. Well, how did they conquer? Well, it was not just a religious movement. They'd come to your house and say, "Can we have a Bible study? And here's my Quran. I want to study the Quran with you." No, they'll bring a sword. They have the power, and you either convert or you die or you pay a tax in some places. It's not just a religious movement. So during these centuries, they built an empire in the political void. And in many places, if they allowed people to live, they had to pay a tax. If you're not going to be a Muslim, you're going to pay a tax. If you don't pay the tax, you'll die. You may live if you pay the tax. You may not live if you pay the tax. They're doing that today in some of the areas that they're conquering. They're putting the tax. We've already noted how many heads they've cut off. So they created an efficient community. And they're in Arabia. And during that time, then they certainly began to convert in periods of time. In the Golden Age, called the 8th to the 12th century of the Islamic faith, they had a lot of building going on and very beautiful structures. There was a series of dynasties during that period of time, and they conquered a lot of territory and made a lot of influence. The Arabic language became very popular, and a lot of the local languages ceased to exist as they began to speak the Arabic language. Of understanding to those who speak Arabic language, it has a lilt or a tune to it that makes it very listenable and likable as they speak in Arabic. But they will say that if you don't speak Arabic, you can't really understand the Quran. I believe that you can. So a difference then, an Arab is an ethnic distinction, someone who is the Arab descent and speaks Arabic, not necessarily all Muslims. The Muslim is a religious distinction, one who follows the religion of Islam, who may or may not be an Arab. So when people say, "Well, those Arabs are just Muslims," no, that's not the right thing. Many Muslims are Arabs, but not all of them are. Then, of course, you have a flourishing civilization during the period of this time, their golden age. They created a lot of algebra, and we have to give them credit for much of the things they did during this period of time. They promoted geometry. They spoke a lot with regard to medicine and healing people. There was a great deal of art involved in their building, and their Sharia law became well known. Their mosques are beautiful buildings, absolutely gorgeous buildings, so they're great in architecture. And they're very aware of this past. In fact, Obama has talked about how wonderful the prayer call is and how much the Muslim community, how much we owe the Muslim community in the past. He speaks about that. During the 11th to the 19th century, they had a decline and they sort of began to slip a little bit and went to sleep so far as world things were concerned. But then they began to convert again. But the thing that held them back was the rise of the European powers. England becomes a power. France becomes a power. Germany becomes a power. And so they hold those back and they weaken the Islamic faith. And the Turkish people became to be very strong. And you had people fighting against that. And the Turks ruled the Middle East. And the European powers became strong, which limited the Islamic faith. And there were many battles during that period of time. Here we have a map, and there's just this shows the European powers, England and Germany and other countries were colonial powers, and they limited the growth of Islam during that period of time. So we see that going on. One man said these manifold, these manifold reversals of fortune created a crisis of thought and faith among the Muslims that shook their civilization to its very roots. The result has been a renewed grasp of Islamic heritage as both a political and a religious state. Apologize for my throat. I've had thyroid surgery, and it's just not back to normal as it should be. But this is what we find today. It's growing. It's alive. It's very vibrant so far as their desire to be a global rule. And that's their goal, is to have Islamic State worldwide. Pardon me. And so, in the 19th century, the Muslims began to grow again and be very political. Also, they developed oil, a lot of oil-rich land, and this has made them very wealthy. And so they've had a tremendous amount of spreading of the wealth, a religious revival, and there's a sense of culture, that is the Islamic culture, that they're very proud of. They believe that Americans are decadent. And you know, I can't very much argue the point. They are modest people from the standpoint of their clothing. American boys and girls are indecent. You go to the mall, you can see that all the time. Watch the television. They would never have beach volleyball with bikinis with their women. That's just not the sort of thing that they do. So they look at America and they say, look how decadent America is. The Islamic culture is a better culture. Well, in some ways, that's true. But the point is that they're looking at us and seeing things in us that ought not be as we, quote, became a Christian nation. What has happened is that we have lost our faith. In fact, we have to mention that America is becoming very secular. I think I mentioned the last time I was here, Europe is called a secular country now. By that, it's not religious. When you go to Europe and you look at the big cathedrals, and they're huge, enormous buildings, beautiful buildings, the only people who go are the tourists. European people are not religious. They're secular. And what the socialists in America are talking about is that America is now post-Christian America. That America is becoming secular like Europe is. And it's true. Many of the religions of the day, the major religions in America, are experiencing a great weakening of the tendons. Where we live in Arlington, on Sunday morning, there will be maybe 1,000 young people on the soccer fields. They don't go to church. Their parents don't go to church. They don't know the Bible. They're not reading the Bible. America's becoming secular. What that does is to weaken America, to change our way of life. We don't have people to have conviction about religion anymore. Diversity has eaten us alive. And the idea, thank you very much. Diversity has caused people to say it doesn't really make any difference what you believe. If you want to be a homosexual, be a homosexual. If you want to be a lesbian, be a lesbian. If you want to be a Catholic, be a Catholic. If you want to be a Muslim, be a Muslim. And so America is very weak in this process that many people, I don't think, understand and realize what a danger that is to us. America, to what degree it had faith in God, is losing its faith in God. That's undeniable. Whatever sense of morality we've had, we find out in politics, morality doesn't matter. Doesn't make any difference. You have a president that's a sexual predator. But that doesn't matter so long as he's a good president. And America has been weakening on the inside. While we're weakening, the Islamic faith is growing and developing. They have a sense of conviction. Now, what I'd like to draw from this for us is that we as Christians understand the necessity of having conviction about things. It may be that our neighbors don't go to church. It may be that our neighbors don't have a sense of morality. But we are the people of the book. We believe the Bible. And the young people that are here this morning prove the point that you can have conviction in a world that has no conviction. That in a secular society, you can be a Christian and live that way. The Apostle Paul spoke of the fact that once they had Christians in Caesar's household. Can you imagine what a difficult thing it would have been to be a Christian in Caesar's household? And yet there they were. They had faith and they lived that faith, even under those adverse circumstances. Now, I don't know what the future holds. I don't claim to be a prophet like Mohammed claimed to be. But I'm telling you that where our nation is in trouble, I can see that just by watching television, by reading the newspapers. Our country is in trouble. our mores, our morals, all these things are in the process of changing. People are giving up religion. That does not have to be true of you. Hold your faith. Hold your conviction. Understand that God is real. Understand that Jesus is the Christ. And let that conviction hold you, so that if it came to the point of persecution, would be like the Apostle John said in Jesus in Revelation 2:10, "Be thou faithful to death, and you'll receive that crown of life." We've got to have that kind of conviction. So, during this renewal, the people clashed with the Islamic people. Many, many wars have been fought. We could go to the Battle of Constantinople and talk about those things, but we just don't have the time to do it. So we're going to be meeting those. The observation that I want to make this morning: the state of the world is one thing, our perspective is another. How I view this as a Christian. This is something that's going to be very personal to me and personal to you. Conflicts have mostly centered around political issues as far as the nations are concerned. People won't have a political solution to the Islamic problem. Well, that's not going to help us at all so far as that's concerned. So Christians need to view these matters from a spiritual and biblical perspective, not an American one. So we wear two hats. I'm an American. I'm proud of it. I like our freedoms. But more than that, I'm a Christian. And you can be a Christian in different nations than America. But here we're going to have to face, as a Christian, some of these things. And what we need to understand then, that our cultures are interacting more than ever, and we've got to be prepared to respond as Christ people to the opportunities that we encounter. The fact of the matter is, this has never changed. It's true today. It was true when Paul was alive. Jesus came to seek and save that which is lost. Now that's our driving goal. We want to convert people to Christ. We talk about tracts, passing out tracts. We talk about radio programs, television programs, personal Bible studies. We don't use a sword. Our enemy is not material like that. Muslims are lost without the blood of Christ, and they need a spiritual rebirth, John 3. And I just want to make the mention this morning. We talked about the Lord's Supper. Muslims do not have a sense of atonement. Their religion is a religion of works. If I'm a good Muslim, I'll go to heaven. If I'm a bad Muslim, I go to hell. They believe in heaven and hell. But they don't have any sense of atonement. So when Muhammad died, he just died. Now they've got his tomb over there, and you can see the tomb. But there was no reason for his death, as we understand the reason for the death of Jesus Christ. Jesus died for the sins of all mankind. The purpose of his death was to save. Muhammad just died. They have no sense of atonement that the blood of Muhammad did anything. We understand the blood of Christ is the saving power of the universe, and we need to understand and do that. So billions of Muslims need the gospel of Christ, and we have to recognize that. Now, they're very difficult to convert. They have that sense of conviction, and many times they will not discuss it with you. But folks, they're lost. They need the gospel. They need the atoning blood of Christ. So in the process of thinking about the Muslim religion or the Islamic religion and speaking to Muslims, as we do that, let's remember they're lost. They need the gospel of Christ. To whatever degree that you can do that, you need to be prepared. Take a track with you. Take a track about Jesus Christ being the Son of God. Hold on to something that you can give to them to read, so they'll be able then to at least consider something else other than what they've been taught from their birth. Because they really teach from their birth. I think many Christians are forgetting this too. And that is that we're supposed to teach our children. They do that. They do that. They teach their children. They may teach their children hate. But they teach their children. Are we forgetting that? So while I look at the Islamic religion and recognize a certain amount of fear for the future for America, I see some good things that they do in their conviction and their dedication that would help us as well. But if you're here this morning, you're not a Christian, what we're doing this morning, just by way of introducing the Islamic religion, is to recognize at the same time the value of our faith. Folks, it's wonderful to be a Christian. It's wonderful to have the truth of the Bible in such plain terms that we can read it and understand it without having some foreign language to interpret. We can simply read the Bible. The Apostle Paul said in Ephesians 3, verse 4, hereby when you read, you'll perceive my understanding in the mystery of Christ. So we encourage us to read the text of the Bible. If you're present this morning and are not a child of God, we invite you to have a sense of dedication and a sense of commitment. We're losing so many young people to the world today. Everywhere you go, in most places, you'll see a congregation full of older people. Now, that's not bad because I are one. But I'm telling you, as the older folks die, who's going to replace us? Where are the young people in many places? They're gone. They're gone to the world. They've gone to college. They've lost their faith. And the Church of Christ is dwindling because we don't have that sense of dedication. Young people, keep your sense of dedication. The Bible is right. Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. It is a way of life for you as well. Not only this life, but the life to come. If you're not a Christian, we need to talk to you and study with you about baptism, the place of the blood of Christ, and the plan of redemption. Invite you to become a Christian even this morning. If you need to obey the gospel of Christ, we invite you forward as we stand together as we sing the invitation song.